The headlines: the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails Iran's support for his country in a meeting with the Iranian Foreign Minister in Beirut. Rights groups blast the UN Human Rights Council for voting to drop its probe into war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. And the U.S. reaffirms its support for Taiwan and confirms a report about secretly training Taiwanese troops amid mounting tensions with China. The top story for this half hour: Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to support Lebanon in all areas. Amir Abdollahian made the remark during a meeting with the Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. On his part, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said Iran has proved that it's an honest ally and a reliable partner during the times of crisis. The top Iranian diplomat is in Lebanon on his first official visit to the country. He has already met with top officials, including President Michel Aoun. During those meetings, Amir Abdollahian made the same pledge to back Lebanon. It's facing fuel shortages triggered by an economic crisis.
For a time too long, Lebanon has been mired in a deep economic crisis. The World Bank says Lebanon's current crisis is possibly among the top three worst crises the world has seen in 150 years. Here is a list of numbers. The currency has lost over 90% of its value since 2019. 78% of the population is estimated to be living in poverty, and 36% are grappling with extreme poverty. Experts put the fault on economic mismanagement and corruption. Also to blame are foreign interventions and sanctions imposed by the United States and its allies to punish Lebanon for the influence the resistance movement Hezbollah enjoys in the country's political structure. Chronic political instability in Lebanon has further exacerbated the crisis. Add to this the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut that inflicted billions of dollars of damage. The situation has led to severe shortages of medicine and fuel and power cuts. The United Nations has sounded the alarm over the dire economic situation and rising hunger in Lebanon.
The situation remains a living nightmare for ordinary people, causing unspeakable suffering and distress for the most vulnerable. Starvation has become a growing reality for thousands of people.
Fortunately, the Lebanese have been hearing some good news for a while. Iran has started exporting fuel to ease the energy crisis. So far, several shipments of fuel have entered the Arab country under a deal arranged by Hezbollah, which has called this a break of the American siege. And last month, a new government was finally appointed, ending 13 months of political wrangling. Earlier this week, Lebanon restarted discussions with the International Monetary Fund after a more than a year-long hiatus to arrange a loan. And now, Iran is assuring the Arab nation of its full support. The Iranian top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Lebanon, saying Tehran is ready to help with development projects in the Arab nation. Specifically, he said Iran is ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild Beirut's port. And Lebanese officials have welcomed this. In a meeting with Amir Abdollahian, President Michel Aoun commended Iran's support for Lebanon and the measures the Islamic Republic has taken to help the nation overcome serious challenges. All this raises hope of better days for crisis-hit Lebanon.
Our correspondent Mariam Saleh is joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, talk to us more about this important meeting that was held between Iran's foreign minister and secretary general of Lebanon's Hezbollah.
Well, of course. course, this meeting has been awaited. We always see a meeting between Islamic Republic of Iran's officials that come to Lebanon with Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. As you know, the ties between the resistance organization and the Islamic Republic go a long way back. So this was something that was always awaited. And this meeting is very significant with the fact and the statements that were said, actually, that we learned from the meeting, which is usually not covered by the media. It is uncovered after it is already adjourned and done. So what we know is that Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has stressed in this meeting that Iran has proven to be a very loyal friend and an ally that does not betray its allies. So this is a very significant statement that we have from Hezbollah. And I believe that this is a message given to the other groups in Lebanon that do depend basically on their support or their alliance or their ties with the United States and other Western countries. So that seems to be the proof that throughout all these decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran's assistance to the resistance, to the government, to the army, and of course with the army, it's not been able to give all that assistance because of political issues, but all the assistance that they have given to the people and the resistance and the government as well have been unconditional. They have been in a form which is always assisting Lebanon without any sort of political conditions. That was put clear by Hezbollah's Secretary General as something that you do not see with other countries in their interference inside Lebanon. Now, we see today also a meeting at the embassy of the Islamic Republic of Iran here in Beirut. We have a group of political factions, Lebanese political factions, that have come today, their representatives, to meet with the foreign minister. We will know, of course, through his press conference, which will be held in around 2 hours from now. We will learn a little bit more about the details of his meetings. We will learn more about the policies of Iran in the region. And as you know, in Lebanon, many regional players have come to put their hands on Lebanon. One of them is Saudi Arabia. We heard some comments on the fact that certain dialogues between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia could actually reflect positively on Lebanon because of the fact that the various political ties from some groups with Saudi Arabia. That is on one hand. On the other hand, Iran has not only presented official statements, has of course vowed and to be ready. Only if the Lebanese officials just say the word, then the Islamic Republic of Iran will be ready to build two power plants in Lebanon to basically once and for all solve the electricity sector, which has been in a detrimental situation for decades. And that is on one hand. On the other hand, they also said that they are ready to take part in the rebuilding process of the Beirut port, which is also very significant. All of this, we heard from the foreign minister say that this is all unconditional support. Now, that is on one side, but with the fact that we do not have clear agreements, and we have been calling for these, Hezbollah's members of parliament, Hezbollah's ministers have been calling for bilateral agreements in order to bring in Iranian fuel through official canals. That did not happen, so therefore Hezbollah had to import Iranian fuel through non-governmental organizations that are supportive of Hezbollah and linked to Hezbollah. So this is why we do see the Iranian fuel coming into Lebanon being imported, which has really assisted Lebanon in a time when it needed it most. Many have considered this humanitarian aid at a time when Lebanon is in an undeclared blockade. So that is on one side, the clear assistance that we have from the Islamic Republic of Iran. And if the Lebanese officials do agree to get more assistance through bilateral agreements, then the situation would change in Lebanon. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah also stressed that he had hopes and aspirations, or he was very much confident that the situation will improve in Lebanon if we do come and reach a state where we do get assistance from countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, we will see how the meetings today unfold and what are the various statements that we will hear from the foreign minister of Iran, in addition to the fact that he always stresses his support, Iran's support for the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine.
All right, thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. U.S. says an imminent return to indirect talks with Iran to revive its 2050 nuclear deal is necessary because the process cannot go indefinitely. State Department spokesman Ned Price says a diplomatic path remains open. He says the U.S. would like negotiations to resume in Vienna as soon as possible. On Wednesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said his country will soon return to the talks to reach an agreement. The Iran nuclear deal got into trouble in 2018 when Washington pulled out of it and reinstated sanctions against Tehran. Iran and the remaining signatories began discussions in Vienna in April this year to revive the accord. Those discussions have been stalled over what Tehran sees as excessive demands by the other side. Tehran also wants all sanctions to be lifted verifiably. Elsewhere, the UN Human Rights Council is facing mounting criticism after it voted to drop its probe into war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies described the vote as a blatant attempt by Riyadh and its allies to ensure blanket impunity for themselves. The Institute said the move will lead to more violence and suffering in Yemen. An independent rights organization in Yemen reacted too. The Mawatana Organization for Human Rights said the measure amounts to a green light for continuing the campaign of death and destruction in Yemen. The UN top rights body ended its probe into war crimes on Thursday. The decision has already drawn strong criticism from some countries and other rights bodies.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen, this is something that is clear to anybody that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against this is just politics, but it's corruption and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
A Pentagon official has confirmed that U.S. Special Operations Forces have been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. The Pentagon official, who wished to remain anonymous, said the training has been going on for less than a year. That followed a report by the Wall Street Journal revealing the secret training. Taiwan's Premier Su Cheng Chang commented on the report. He said that Taiwan tries to defend its national sovereignty. Pentagon spokesman John Supple also commented. He said U.S. support for Taiwan's military is aligned against what he called a current threat by China. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and opposes the island seeking independence. China says U.S. military support for Taiwan threatens regional peace and has repeatedly urged Washington to stop that. Political analyst Andrew Lloyd says the U.S. measure to secretly give training to Taiwanese troops crosses China's red line on its One China policy.
Tensions has been rising because the United States seems to be dramatically increasing the frequency of these so-called freedom of navigation patrols, naval patrols near the, in the South China Sea, and has also arming Taiwan with more modern weapons. And now, according to the latest report, the United States has been secretly training Taiwanese army inside Taiwan. That means the stationing of American forces in Taiwan itself. Of course, this is an affront to their alleged confirmation of the so-called one China policy. And of course, the Beijing would never allow Taiwan to split off from the motherland. And this is an absolute red line, according to Beijing.
Some Iraqi groups are taking part in early voting for parliamentary elections set for Sunday. Members of security forces, as well as diplomats and expats, are now casting their ballots. The elections will choose 329 members of parliament from among over 3,000 candidates. More than 25 million people are eligible to vote. A new single-member constituency system for electing lawmakers is supposed to boost independence versus the traditional political blocs. The elections are taking place a year earlier than scheduled time. That's an effort to respond to demands raised during protests that broke out in 2019. Those protests called for change and an end to corruption in Iraq. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started the explanation of Surah Qaf, the 50th surah in order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and today we continue from where we left you. Here are ayahs 9, 10, and 11.
وَنَزَّلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً مباركا فأنبتنا به جنات وحب الحصيد والنخل باسقات لها طلع نضيد رزقا للعباد وأحيينا به بلدة ميتا كذلك الخروج.
And we sent down from the sky salubrious water, with which we grew gardens, and the grain which is harvested, and tall date palms with regularly ranged clusters, as a provision for servants, and with it we revive a dead country. Likewise, will be the rising from the dead. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Qaf that speak of God's infinite power, saying that the disbelievers ought to look at the sky above and the earth in order to perceive the reality of resurrection, the earth, the sky, the planets, and the entire universe are undeniable proofs of the power and glory of God, who makes the whole universe function on an orderly basis. The ayahs that we recited to you refer to rainfall and the resurgence of vegetation after losing its greenery during winter, in order to make us realize the reality of resurrection of the dead. Rain is a natural phenomenon, but it depends on divine will. It rejuvenates the earth, provides it with blessings, including growth of plants, delicacy of the air, and flowing of streams. Rainfall and growth of plants are mentioned to illustrate the day of resurrection. Ayah 10 mentions tall date palms with ranged clusters that indicate the bearing of fruits, which is indeed the most joyous moments for farmers as the crop ripens for harvest. The next ayah means to say that this natural process provides sustenance to the creatures, and thus the revival of vegetation in a seemingly dead land is another example of the Almighty's power in resurrection of the dead on the Day of Judgment. In other words, the rising of humans from their graves will be like the revival of plants. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, rain is a great blessing as it revives the seemingly dead plants and makes greenery reappear. Number two, date palm and fruits are of special significance among trees and plants. Hence, God has specifically mentioned it. Number three, plants and trees are the source of freshness, greenery, and beauty, in addition to being means of sustenance and a sign of revival after death. Facts that ought to arouse human conscience regarding God's power to revive the dead human beings to life. Now let us listen to ayahs 12, 13, and 14 of the same surah.
كذبت قبلهم قوم نوح وأصحاب الرس وثمود وعاد وفرعون وإخوان لوط وأصحاب الأيكة وقوم تبع كل كذب الرسل فحق وعيد.
The people of Noah denied truth before them, and so did the inhabitants of Ras and Thamud, and Ad, Pharaoh, and the brethren of Lot, and the inhabitants of Vaikar, and the people of Tobah. Each of them belied the prophets, and so my threat became due against them. These ayahs remind the prophet and the believers of the prophets of the past and the fate suffered by the people to whom they were sent, but faced persecution and denial of divine message. Thus, here God Almighty consoles his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The ayah means to say that if the pagan Arabs hurt you and belie you, do not feel sad, because this is the habit of the disbelievers from the beginning. In addition, these ayahs are a warning to the disbelievers of their fate and torments reserved for them if they continue to mock at the prophets of God. The account of the great flood that drowned the wicked people of the days of Prophet Noah is known to all. As for the inhabitants of Ras, it is said this tribe lived in Yamama in Arabia, and it threw Prophet Hanzalah into a well after denying his call to desist from their unnatural and abominable sexual ways. According to the Prophet of Islam's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the reason behind the divine torment inflicted upon the inhabitants of Ras was that the women contented themselves with women, that is, they were lesbians. Thamud was a tribe in northwestern Arabia for whose guidance God had sent Prophet Saleh, whom they mocked and mercilessly killed. The she-camel, which was among the divine signs. Ad was a tribe in southern Arabia to whom Prophet Hud was sent, whose efforts to guide them toward God yielded no result, and as a result of their disbelief and wickedness, they were inflicted with divine wrath. Pharaoh was the tyrannical king of Egypt who denied Prophet Moses' call to the right path and was subsequently drowned along with his troops. Prophet Lot was a relative of Prophet Abraham and was accompanied by God to guide the erring people of Sodom, who were destroyed for indulging in the unnatural practice of homosexuality, hence the word Sodomite for such persons. The inhabitants of Aika is reference to the forested area around the Gulf of Aqaba, spanning parts of northern Arabia, Jordan, and the Sinai Peninsula, where the people used to worship a tall tree. They refused to heed the call of Prophet Shu'aib to return to monotheism and desist from their dishonest ways of shortchange and cheating, and as a result were destroyed. Tobah was the title of kings of the Yemen. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the all-merciful Creator has raised prophets throughout history in every place and nation to guide human beings to the straight and unwavering path that leads to paradise, and to save them from the satanic ways of atheism, polytheism, and all sorts of disbelief and deviation that end up in hell. Number two, since mankind is the best of creation, endowed with the power of intellect and speech, we have to use our God-given brains to choose the right path and save ourselves from divine wrath. And number three, many of the nations of the past committed abominable sins, belied the prophet, and were afflicted with divine wrath. And therefore, these ayahs are an admonishment for all future generations. Now, let's listen to Ayah 15 as the concluding Ayah of this episode.
أَفَعَيْنَا بِالْخَلْقِ الْأَوَّلِ بَلْ هُمْ فِي لَبْسٍ مِّنْ خَلْقٍ جَدِيدٍ
Were we exhausted by the first creation? Rather, they are in doubt about a new creation. This ayah refers to the irrationality of the disbelievers and polytheists, many of whom, though acknowledging God as the creator of the universe, are unable to fully comprehend the infinite power of the Lord Most High. Disbelievers may not produce any argument for substantiating their denial of resurrection, but they merely entertain doubts. In other words, this ayah asks disbelievers whether they imagine that God Almighty is tired of the first creation and He is unable to create anew. Disbelievers are mistaken about divine omnipotence to create anew, since they are unable to produce any argument for substantiating their denial of resurrection, and merely entertain doubts. Thus, this ayah means to say, were we unable to create you in the first place? So, why are you in doubt about our ability for recreating you in your original form and shape after death has turned your bodies into dust? We'll learn these points from this ayah. Number one, the doubts of the disbelievers about God's power to revive the dead on the day of resurrection have no basis, because the one who has created a being from naught can surely do it again. Number two, we should apply the cross-questioning method in our discourse with the deniers of truth, in order to awaken their minds to the ultimate truth. And number three, the deniers of the day of resurrection have no logic and only insist on their doubts.
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, has done it again. A trove of records has been revealed on how politicians and official figures evaded taxes through offshore tax havens. Financial secrets of politicians, billionaires, and the global elite included the likes of the former UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair, in which it revealed that he avoided paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this practice of avoiding taxes using offshore tax havens continues, and why authorities have failed to stop it.
It's being described as the Panama Papers of 2016 on steroids. The Pandora Papers, a leak of almost 12 million documents allegedly linking some of the world's richest and most powerful to huge secret assets, tax avoidance, and money laundering. It's the job of hundreds of journalists in more than 100 countries, spending months combing through files as part of the largest ever global financial investigation. Among their findings, secret financial dealings of the King of Jordan, President of Russia, the President of Kenya, and hundreds more politicians and celebrities, some of whom allegedly used shell companies to buy properties here in the UK.
Oxfam have calculated that the amount concerned comes to some $427 billion lost to national economies and tax around the world. Money could be spent on hospitals, schools, all the things that the masses of the people need, especially as we come out of this global pandemic and the economic crisis that has spawned.
One of the two British names so far in the revelations, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who allegedly avoided paying hundreds of thousands in property tax on a townhouse while buying the company which owned it.
And this is a guy, Blair, who never tires of going around the world telling other people how they should live their lives. He's treated as an elder statesman in British politics. The media had never done having him on their show to give his views on all the issues of the day. A man who's got the blood of a million Iraqis and more in the region on his hand.
The other Briton named Mohamed Amirsi, a major Conservative Party donor who funded Boris Johnson's campaign to become Prime Minister, involved in one of Europe's biggest corruption scandals. The UK Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has promised an investigation into the revelations. But when asked whether he was ashamed that London is a haven for those looking to get out of paying their fair share, he said he was not.
He himself is a former top executive of Goldman Sachs, so he's plugged into this kind of thing. He knows it goes on. I'm sure sotto voce, he would say that's part and parcel of the game.
Some are now questioning whether the UK is doing enough to regulate the use of shell companies and tax avoidance measures. Analysts say this makes it harder for citizens to trust their leaders. For now, those allegations in the so-called Pandora Papers are, well, allegations. There's no proof that any of the individuals mentioned in this story broke any laws. But whether those laws will have to change is something that the public will have to debate and decide. Site Tourism, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, joins us from Bristol. And we also have journalist and political analyst John Bostanich, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And let me first start with you, John Bosnich, and ask you if you can, for people who may not know what this is all about in terms of the revelations, what tax evasion is, what offshore tax havens are they legal, are they not, and what it is that these politicians, billionaires, and official figures have actually done.
Well, it's definitely a complicated web, and the purpose of these havens is to deceive the tax inspection authorities of the home countries of the politicians and persons involved. The real reason for these havens is not just to avoid taxes. If it were just an accounting matter about how much money the individual politicians and other powerful individuals owe to their state governments, that would be another matter. The real reason that this is such a scandal is that the purpose of the tax havens is to hide the existence of the money. And the reason that the existence of the money is being hidden is because much, if not all of the money, comes in the form of bribery. That's the issue at heart of this problem.
Okay, now you've opened another door here. So let me get back to you on the bribery thing and ask you, Tani Goslin, if you can explain to us the depth of what this is so we can get an idea for those who may not have even heard of what has occurred, because we're looking at pretty large figures, 330 politicians, high-level public officials in more than 90 countries. You could probably tell us better.
Well, you know what? I think it's interesting to see who is in this list, because the likes of Rishi Sunak, he's saying, oh, well, we're going to have an investigation, the British Chancellor. But he's the sort of individual that could actually be using some of these techniques to hide his own wealth. And certainly that's the sort of thing he would have been coached to do at Goldman Sachs. So I'm a little bit cautious when I see a big league like this. Blair, for example, is a major figure. But this is the sort of thing that everybody is doing. It's not, in a way, not news. If it was a criminal offence that he'd been committing, then it would be. But many, many wealthy and powerful people are doing this sort of thing all the time, de rigueur. And it's actually part of a sort of, almost a secret club of the super rich, the super wealthy, that get on and do this. And there's a lot of people, I think, that are not on this list that may well be up to these kind of techniques. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of political leaders, a lot of celebrities, names which, you know, many people will recognise. But what about those names that people wouldn't recognise? Big business leaders, you know, so for example, from the pharmaceutical industry, the likes of Bill Gates, for example, using these sorts of techniques. And so I think what I'm trying to say here is that there's a tremendous amount of discretion at the Washington, D.C.-based ICIJ that's released all this as to who they dob in and which documents they release, or whoever's leaked it to them, and who they don't. So, yes, it's obviously something needs to be done about the massive amount of tax avoidance going on in offshore jurisdictions. And many of these, of course, are British overseas territories, for example. But then Switzerland is an enormous great one. It's very difficult to know how these sorts of places can actually be closed down as tax havens without international agreement. And this, of course, is another side to all of this is there going to be ever some sort of international agreement? There's a lot of push for it at the moment. In fact, Rishi Sunak himself has been saying this, that we've got to have some sort of agreement, and this is a further push. But I'm a little bit suspicious when I see that certain very powerful and important names, for example, people involved in the British royalty, do not appear to be on this list, and yet these are the sorts of techniques that what they would have been using regularly. Uh-huh. Also, we've got to look at the funding for these sorts of big journalistic organisations. Now, you would have thought, for example, with hundreds of journalists working on a topic, that there are all sorts of, for example, dodgy deals in the arms trade that these journalists may have and should have found out. But no, they're handed all this information. And this organisation, the ICIJ, in a way, is a sort of competitor to WikiLeaks. Remember, Julian Assange now has done 10 years in jail. And I just did have a look to see what they had to say about Assange. And actually, there was an article by Yossi Melman, who is actually opposing Assange, saying, oh, Assange is terrible, blah, blah. So this is the sort of new way, post-WikiLeaks, that stuff is coming out. And it's very partial. So some people will be dished the dirt on, and other people will get off scot-free.
Okay, well, I have to ask you, John Bosnich, what you meant by bribery, and tell us if you can name names, and tell us overall what percentage of this money we're looking at is in the form of bribery.
Well, I don't think I'm opening any new doors of perception here. The fact of the matter is that a large number of the leading military and economic powers of this world today, of well-known, well-respected countries, are themselves the subject of an oligarchical power network inside their countries. And so these state leaders, these prime ministers and these presidents, are becoming more and more not the initiators of policy, but the presenters of policy. They are like a narrator of a film in which they themselves are not an actor. They play the part of head of state. They play the part of head of government. But in fact, they are being selected because they look good on camera. They are believable to the gullible population of the country, and they follow orders from their own domestic deep state, and be that America, England, France, or any other influential transnational entity, because these countries do not operate only within their own borders, but they use their own state as a base for raiding and controlling other states. This is the bigger aspect of this issue. It is not just a question of crooked politicians avoiding taxes. If it were, it would not be nearly the story that it is. This is a story of crooked politicians who are selected to be politicians because they're crooked before they even start. They are then placed in power using multi-million dollar political campaigns, which are fine-tuned to deceive the public into picking one or more of the controlled political puppets. These puppets are then paid their bribes and their money under the table, which they then hide offshore. That is the entire scenario.
Tony Gosling, do you have a reaction? And if you do agree, who would be at the top of the list?
Well, the top of what list?
The top of the list of what description that John Bosnich gave in terms of a politician, let's say.
Well, look, politicians are actually fairly low down the food chain. Obviously, the celebrities, they sell newspapers, and so there's a legitimate interest in them, and of course in the politicians because they're known faces. But at the top of the list, I mean, I think in terms of who we need to be keeping an eye on, and I'm not entirely sure that that's what's been going on here, people looking at those, the most rich and most powerful who operate behind the scenes. We're talking really here about the pharmaceutical industry, big oil, also, of course, the fintech sector, that financial technology, and the finance sector, the City of London, at Wall Street, all these kinds of characters. And I think the journalists aren't doing themselves any favours by concentrating, and there may well be other leaks that we've only just come across this massive dossier of people who are in these very rich and powerful positions. Those are the sorts of people who I would be much more interested to see them, because they like to stay in the shadows. And in fact, by concentrating on the sort of celebrity status of the people who are in these leaks, the journalists are almost playing their game. I mean, the Bureau of Investigative Journalists in London was run for a while by Ian Overton. And I remember having a conversation with him saying, well, look, when is the Bureau of Investigative Journalists going to look into the big questions there are around the 7/7 London bombings? And he told me, he said, well, actually, there's no need to do an investigation. We know exactly what happened. And this, I'm afraid, is the attitude amongst some of these organisations around the world that have got massive budgets and loads of journalists on their side, is they don't want to look into the really deep, dark crannies where where people like me, freelance journalists like myself, know that some of the most important facts lie. And so also we have to ask the question, where are these leaks from? Who has actually leaked them to these journalists? And I would suggest it's probably financial sector people, and also possibly intelligence services. Because if you look at the numbers of politicians, there's a definite bias towards the whole Western anti-Russian, anti-Eastern European attitude. That is to say, you know, various people around the world, including, by the way, this organization, the ICIJ, did a whole leak very recently, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, looking at China through the prism of the Uyghurs, saying, oh, look, all these Uyghurs have given us all this information about how terrible the Chinese are. Well, this is just following, you know, the Western geopolitical agenda. Right. And I have a real tendency to look at these big leaks. Yes, there's some fascinating information in there, but really just part of a you know, anti-China, okay, anti-Russian propaganda campaign.
Well, one of the things that we need to talk about here, John Bostich, is, which the ICIJ mentioned, is how, and it called it the most troubling, one of the most troubling revelations, and it said is the U.S. and the role that South Dakota, Nevada, and other states had adopted in terms of financial secrecy, and how they're being used as actually, in a sense, tax havens, it said, rivaling those of offshore jurisdictions. And obviously revealing America's complicity in the matter. Tell us what your thoughts are on South Dakota, Nevada, and other states maybe that you can tell us in terms of the way it has served that purpose, which is an offshore economy, as it said.
Well, of course, these are euphemistically referred to as liberalized financial sectors in Nevada and other states in the United States. They use the word liberalized to suggest that there's some more form of freedom. Well, yes, there is more freedom, and that's the freedom to steal and to bribe and to coerce by financial means. The fact that there are these kinds of internal havens in the United States is merely a reflection of the fact that the United States is the physical and financial center of the Anglo-American Empire, which grew out of the colonial empire of England. So this is just an old way of doing business. It was illegal, and it was permanently illegal in England and in the United States as they built their empire. But the judges and the prosecutors and the lawyers were paid and given status in society to look the other way. These things have now been leaked. It is a certainty that there are financial authorities involved in getting access to the leaked information and filtering it out to the public in a manner that's understandable. But it is even more likely and more certain that it is the interference in domestic Western affairs, these are their words, by Russian, Chinese, and other intelligence services who have discovered a treasure trove of the criminal activities of the leading investment bankers, the leading politicians, the leading public thinkers, and the leading communicators of the Anglo-American Empire. And this is the crux of the matter. They not only choose to dominate the world anti-democratically and illegally by force of arms and by coercion, but after they dominate the world, they still don't even admit the amount of money that they take for themselves as just simple graft and bribery. And now that these data are being released, the entire lid is off of the matter, and the way things are done in the West and around the world should change. And journalists, and this is a comment that I join my fellow commentator in expressing today, is it's high time that journalists were journalists and not paid propagandists for the media owned by the oligarchies of the countries in which they live.
Well, I'm guessing, Tony Gosling, not guessing, but I'm thinking that this is a good thing that these types of revelations are being released.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And I want to come at you, Tony Gosling, if I may, through the span of what the ICIJ had in its report in terms of, for example, the offshore holdings. And it said offshore holdings of more than 130 billionaires from 45 countries. Now, when you have 130 billionaires who are not paying their taxes, according to Forbes, 100 of the billionaires had a collective fortune of more than $600 billion. Now, we're looking at that while millions across the world are living in poverty, okay? Especially now when COVID has hit, you're looking at 150 million people to have fallen into poverty. These taxes that they're not paying could be going towards nation building. So that isn't that one way of looking at this?
Well, the trouble is at the moment, paying tax in many of the Western countries is simply something that goes on repayment of national debts. So it doesn't necessarily go to public services and spending here in the West anymore. After the 2008 bailouts and also succeeding bailouts, much of the revenue that is taken in tax simply goes in debt repayments. And so this is, I mean, I'm not saying it's not, we shouldn't be getting the tax off these people. Of course we should. And in fact, for almost all those billionaires will be able to take half of their wealth away from them. And they wouldn't notice any difference whatsoever in their lifestyle. In fact, you could probably take 90% of their wealth away from them and they wouldn't notice any difference in their lifestyle whatsoever. So that's the sort of excess wealth they've got. And of course, you know, in any kind of just world, that wealth that should be... I mean, for example, we're in a situation now, aren't we, where some of the super wealthy are just playing games with shooting rockets to the moon for space tourism. You know, your Richard Bransons, the Musks, etc. And this is because they've got far too much wealth and they've been able to keep it to themselves. And it's just a little kind of toy they're playing with. Of course, that wealth needs to be taken. But there is a much bigger side to this, as you've said, between the maldistribution of wealth, the perverse concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny number of people, and land, by the way, in the hands of a tiny number of people. And in order to do something about that, we have to do something about these tax, what they call secrecy jurisdictions, as John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network regularly talks about. He's just retiring, which is a shame to see. But, you know, this is what they've been concentrating on. And in the Anglo-Zionist Empire, there is a battle going on right now, and that is a battle between the financial elite, the financial oligarchy, who largely are anonymous behind the scenes, and the democratic and media institutions which guarantee us our freedom. Those are on the back foot and they're losing. And I see this as possibly anyway, another actual assault on our democratic institutions and, you know, some of our personalities that are behind media. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but also the timing is really interesting, very important here in the UK. This has just happened at the cusp between last week's Labour conference and this week's Conservative conference. So of the Labour donors will be being ignored,
okay,
and all the Conservative donors, Conservative conference season, everyone's forgotten about the other side. So this is an assault on the Conservative, who are really the only people opposing internationalism at the moment here in Britain.
Okay. Last word to you, John Bosnich. So a couple of statements there made by Tony Galson said something should be done about it. Department of Justice in the U.S., other justice departments across the world looking at these troves and revelations. Why don't they jump at this and go after the ones who are evading taxes illegally?
Well, we go back to the conspiratorial nature of this entire subject matter. Yes, we've got oligarchs who have enriched themselves personally. They then effectively purchase politicians to use them as pawns in the further expansion of their wealth. And the last element of all of this, and it's the element that we've seen over the past 20 years in particular, is that once they've bought up the wealth and assembled the wealth as the richest people in the world, and they've bought up their politicians and made them into personal assets, the last and most effective and destructive step is they buy up the media. The so-called lying mainstream media that President Trump used to